if you look at oncology, they don't wait for the guidelines to come out. They're just starting the meds. I mean, like, we do that off-label as well, but I think that on-label drugs that have proven data and clinicians just aren't using that information because they either don't have it at their fingertips, they may have heard of the trial, they may not have known the results, but they don't really know the use cases that well. Like, we're missing so many opportunities to adopt proven therapies in timely fashion. Like, it's really, you know, absolutely, something that I think this is really striking at the core of.
You know, for me, moving from outcomes research into these large clinical trials, I think you still need so much more to be done with respect to implementation science.
You're listening to Beyond the Chart with Stanford cardiologist Dr. Raj Dash, powered by Clint, the clinical intelligence platform. Today, Raj is joined by Joanne Foody, Chief Medical Officer at Esperion.
Hello, and welcome to the Beyond the Chart podcast. I am your host, Rajesh Dash. I'm the co-founder of Clint and a cardiologist in prevention and digital health at Stanford University. And I am delighted and honored to have Dr. Joanne Foody joining us today for the podcast. We'll get into a lot of details about Joanne and her background. She is currently the Chief Medical Officer for Esperion Therapeutics, a life sciences company that is dedicated to reducing cardiovascular risk and which has had some very exciting achievements in the past few months, which we'll definitely dive into on today's interview. For those listeners who may not know her background in detail, please allow me to give a brief summary. I've tried to condense this as much as I can, but there's a lot. Dr. Foody is a board-certified cardiologist. She's a fellow of the American Heart Association and of the American College of Cardiology. And she's really been a thought leader in cardiovascular medicine and lipidology for more than 25 years. After a highly successful academic career at both Yale and Harvard Medical Schools, where she led important discovery science in lipidology. In fact, she spent over 2 decades in academia establishing herself as truly an international expert and thought leader in preventive cardiology with over 200 peer-reviewed publications. Joanne then leapt from academia to industry, beginning her corporate career at Merck Research Labs as Global Director of Scientific Affairs and Cardiovascular and Metabolism, where she led teams that were supporting ezetimibe, as well as investigations into small molecules targeting atherosclerosis, heart failure, hypertension, and pulmonary hypertension. She then left Merck and spent the next 6 years at Johnson & Johnson and Janssen, where she rose rapidly to become the vice president and head of data sciences for cardiovascular, metabolic disease, pulmonary hypertension in retinal therapeutic areas as well. And along the way, she also served as Janssen's vice president and compound development leader for Xarelto, which we all know is a multi-billion dollar compound. And prior to that, she had led cardiovascular medical affairs for Janssen as well. So she joined Esperion, I forget, how many years ago has it been?
Just about 3 years.
3 years.
Raj, you're doing great. thank you for the intro.
And right now, you're responsible for an enormous amount at the company, clinical development, operations, R&D, pharmacovigilance, international development, medical affairs, it goes on and on. And so, first of all, thank you for joining us and taking time out of an incredibly busy schedule that I know you have. It's really lovely to see you again, and welcome.
Yeah, Raj, thank you so much. Thank you for the kind words. Thank you for the introduction. And it really is a delight to be able to chat with you on some of these insights. And it's always been a pleasure working with you and your teams over the years.
Well, thank you. Likewise. And you know, such a huge list of accomplishments. You've had this amazing journey. And for me personally, it's really inspiring to see how you transitioned from academia to industry so seamlessly. And you've done so well in the industry portion of your career. What was it about your experiences in academia that maybe have helped you in your industry career, some of the rigor that you had to go through? Has that helped? And what do you miss the most about academics?
Well, Raj, thank you so much for the question. I think there's a lot to unpack there. I think first and foremost, you know, throughout my academic career, throughout my industry career, my North Star, if you will, has always been how to ensure that patients receive optimal care and, you know, how we can do better, particularly in the preventive realm. And so, you know, throughout my career have been highly focused on identifying risk, intervening earlier to reduce those risks, and hopefully prevent events, hopefully put cardiologists out of business, if we will, for those events. But I think, you know, as I think about academics, you know, always first and foremost, I was always very data driven. So in my academic career was really focused on what at the time was called outcomes research, right? How do we take big data? How do we garner insights? How do we then use those in ways in which we can improve care, in which we can better identify patients most appropriate for therapies, and how we can garner insights of where the gaps in care may lie. And so in that capacity, you know, worked across big data like CMS data sets with the National MI and Heart Failure Projects or within the VA to improve quality of care. And then ultimately leveraging those insights to inform quality measures, guidelines, and the like. And so, you know, in academics, also consulted with industry to help industry leaders and big pharma understand how to maybe accelerate adoption of therapies, how to ensure that trials were designed in ways that could be most representative of the patients in which they wanted to apply a therapy, and ensure, importantly, across that diversity. So all those skills, I think, that were developed in academics, again, with the patients front and foremost in that, translated very well to industry. And I've been fortunate to be at both large and small companies where the patient is the guiding principle, right? You know, how do we ensure with integrity that we're developing therapies that will address unmet need and improve patients' lives?
That's awesome. And I can see how that has translated into a really natural sort of leadership style for you as well. And I think in those 3 years, the last 3 years at Esperion, you've had some pretty amazing wins as a company. What are you most proud of in terms of what it might mean for the field of lipidology, cardiovascular risk, and also health equity? Would love to hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah, so moving to Esperion, the opportunity that I saw was to perhaps, and ultimately we were able to, develop an oral therapy to address cardiovascular risk by lowering lipids. And I think 3 years ago when I came to the organization, was fortunate to help conclude the large CLEAR Outcomes study, which was 14,000 patients, global study studying bempedoic acid against placebo in individuals at risk for cardiovascular disease or those with existing cardiovascular disease. And what was critical for me and important throughout my career is the fact that this was a study, I think one of the first studies in the lipid lowering space to have parity with respect to women enrolled and men enrolled. So I think first, that in and of itself was a major accomplishment for our teams at Esperion, and one that I think is really unique, understanding that we don't always have enough data to make inferences around therapies in women. So fast forward, we were able to successfully close out the study and are able to present the results as a late-breaking clinical trial over a year ago at the American College of Cardiology. Dr. Steve Nissen, our chair of our study, presented that, and we were thrilled with the results. Now come full circle, just about a month and a half ago, we achieved a label, again, ensuring that patients with heart disease, at risk for heart disease, have a new oral therapy. In fact, the first one or the first and only non-statin since in 20 years, right? Available as an oral pill to reduce risk in both primary and secondary prevention. So for me, if I go back to my roots, it's always about how can one support and develop transformational therapies, therapies that really have the ability to change the paradigm. So again, I feel thrilled to work with the team that I have at Esperion to execute this trial, the patients that contributed, all the site PIs, the investigators, all the global community that it takes to execute a large cardiovascular outcome trial. And so these are not for the faint of heart, Raj, but are required, right, given the bar that's set for cardiovascular therapies.
That's amazing. And congratulations. It's a really tremendous accomplishment. And being now, you know, practicing in cardiology for as long as I have, it is truly a significant contribution for our day-to-day care for patients. I think one of the things, there are actually two things that I wanted to kind of come back to on these studies. 50% women, right? I mean, this is rare and incredible. And can you maybe educate our listeners a little bit more about how different this is from a typical cardiovascular outcomes trial? Like why that is so impactful for our understanding of how we use our medications and that they actually work for the whole population?
Absolutely. And look, I think it's great that we've done this and achieved 50% women. We're still not there, though, with respect to ethnic and racial minorities. But let me talk a little bit about some of the gender gaps. I think in cardiovascular, there are a couple things, right? One, traditionally, large cardiovascular outcome trials have on average only included about best case a quarter women. Some of that extends from the fact that women are less likely to be diagnosed, less likely to know they're even at risk for heart disease. And there's a construct that in fact is not correct that women don't get heart disease, right? That cardiovascular disease, heart disease is a man's disease. So, the other issue that's important is that we, in order to have women in trials, we have to ensure that we are studying diseases as they present in women. And what we learned from this study was, in fact, that because this study was a study of people unable or unwilling to take statins, that women, in fact, have far more symptoms with statins than men. And the additional fact is that the majority of statin doses, particularly the high doses, had been only really adequately studied in men. And so there was a perception that women may have more symptoms with statins. I think we found that out. So in fact, women flocked to the study and because it represented a disease, a unique attribute of the disease in them. I think the other thing is if we think about even procedures in cardiovascular disease, only until recently when newer stents of smaller caliber have been studied or new approaches to valvular heart disease with smaller annulus, for example, in valves have been studied, have we started to be able to get closer to parity for women? So I think it's important that we always think about ways in which to study the disease as it presents in men and or women, in ethnic and racial minorities, which may have different presentations. So we have to design trials in a way that it addresses the unique attributes. Otherwise, we can never achieve that kind of parity or enrollment that we would to give the insights to the clinical community on how to care for groups.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's astounding that when you look at the usual makeup of these trials, you know, predominantly men, predominantly white men, and we are really approving all of these drugs right and left for the general population, despite them not really being proven in those subpopulations and not being representative of the disease generally. You know, we'll definitely dive into sort of how real-world data can help us understand what we need to do in terms of sometimes we don't even know the populations we should be doing the trials in. So we need that real-world data to help educate us. And then how do you leverage it to really make it, you know, useful for trial design, trial execution, and really getting to that representative cohort. We'll dive into that in a moment. But before I leave sort of the clinical trial results, and I was sitting at that late breaker, I remember just looking over at my colleague Shree and being like, wow, you guys really crushed it. I mean, it was really an impressive array of results. And, you know, we talk about the something called clinical inertia, where patients and physicians and care, you know, clinicians of all sorts are not starting medications maybe as aggressively as they should, or thinking of all the opportunities that a patient may have in front of them. And you mentioned that this being, you know, since statins, really the first significant oral medication that has been shown to have results like this. And I think that a lot of the time when we think about PCSK9 inhibitors and the insurance approvals that really have to go well in order for patients to even be able to afford them, as well as the delivery not being, you know, as attractive to patients as taking a pill might be, I really feel like this is hitting a sweet spot within clinical care and risk reduction for patients. And is that something that you also are thinking around? And right now, is it something that, you know, you're seeing pretty good sort of feedback from the community as far as it being available, it being affordable, it being sort of well received by patients?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's you know, so many challenges, I think, as we think about our ability to prevent diseases, right? And as you mentioned, that clinical inertia is certainly a challenge. But I think we have to step back, right? As clinicians, we take an oath to first do no harm. And so really trying to find the therapies with respect to lipid lowering that first can do no harm, I think we really now have an appealing option of an early combination approach of medications to address risk. So I think lipid lowering space has been quite different than, if you will, the hypertension space or the diabetes space. There we apply a variety of medications together, mostly oral to start, although now, for example, in diabetes, more in injections and having the history with insulin. But if we look at hypertension, right, we would never apply a single drug to its maximal intensity and potential max side effects before we switch to a second antihypertensive. We right. use a combination approach to hit multiple pathways so that we can optimize blood pressure lowering and minimize the side effects.
Right.
I think now with proven data from bempedoic acid with cardiovascular risk reduction, fixed dose combinations with ezetimibe and statins, we have the ability to really lean into the concept that even lower, even earlier, maybe even better. Right. And that's what we do with blood pressure, right? We try right. to use multiple drugs together early on so that we don't have the complications of hypertensive urgency, emergency or strokes. I think now we truly have the opportunity, particularly now with a drug proven like a statin to reduce risk in primary prevention, to start lower doses earlier to optimize lipids and address, I'll say, that area under the curve, right? Yeah. A more life course approach. And starting earlier, identifying risk, because now we have therapies that maybe are easier also for clinicians, but most importantly, patients to take to optimize lipids, right. optimize inflammation, and reduce risk overall.
That's fantastic. Yeah, I think it makes a lot of sense. I know you've had an interest in understanding what is likely to happen to patients. And I say that as another way to say risk models and understanding the risk of a patient a little bit more granularly, maybe a lot more granularly than we currently do. I mean, I'm still amazed that we use 10-year risk scores to help us guide treatment for patients. And when you think about now, again, on that clinical inertia piece, how do you convince a patient to take a medication when you're telling them that their risk is 7 or 8 or 9% to have a heart attack in the next 10 years? How do you convince a clinician to really start earlier, as you said, and move the needle on the LDL lower earlier in the life cycle of the disease, if you're giving them something that's such a long horizon of risk? And do you feel like there's a role for better risk models that are giving us 1-year risk, 2-year risk, that are strong, that are accurate, and better than our pooled cohorts equation that we currently use? I mean, like, isn't that something that is almost necessary to kind of take the value of these kinds of medications that are showing the benefit, and the curves are separating early? I mean, they're not taking 10 years to separate. They're separating, you know, within a year, 2 years of starting the medication. Why aren't we giving risk models that are 1 and 2 year risk models to really move the needle on inertia?
Yeah, it's really a challenge. I think we have the ability with the totality of data we have to do a much better job. I don't think we're there yet, right? I think we truly could, in fact, lean into precision medicine, right? To really understand at the individual patient level what is driving their unique risk, as well as what are the therapies that they may be more or less likely to respond to from an efficacy perspective. Yep. Or more or less likely to have a safety side effect from them, right? We haven't gotten there yet, but that's sort of aspirational. And I know we work in industry, we work with partners like you to really define those trajectories, right? And deeply phenotype, genotype patients. I think short of that, we're starting to move to risk models, but there's always a tension, right? There's always what can we put into a risk model, a calculator, if you will, that is easy to use and has readily available clinical data and can still be informative. I think, but that therein lies the catch, right? I think we have a lot of risk models. The new AHA Prevent score, which now looks at, you know, cardiometabolic diseases and kidney risk, is starting to move and push the envelope much earlier, so that individuals now at an age of 30 could start to look at something like their 30-year risk. But again, ultimately, all of these are tools that have to be placed in the hands of a clinician for individual patient provider decision making. And a tool is only as good as it is used. And I think one of our challenges with all of these, Raj, and we can talk about it, as unless these tools are embedded within the day-to-day, this is my opinion, within the day-to-day care and practice in a way that automatically accumulates all those data and provides a risk that a provider can interpret, but importantly that a patient can interpret relative to their risks, benefits, alternatives. I don't think that we will get there with respect to truly helping patients understand their risk and understanding how to manage that risk over their life course. Yep. We're getting there, but lots more work to do.
That's totally aligned with how I think about it. It's great to hear that from you. I think it's something that, you know, almost as a companion diagnostic or a companion decision-making, you know, risk models that are real-time, that are personalized, that are tied to evidence of what to do with the information, not just give them the risk, but give them the options and give them the impact of one versus another treatment pathway. And I think when we have this tremendous cardiovascular clinical data across so many trials that we've done, and we are able to then bring that back, whether it's a guideline or it's just really strong clinical trial data, but it's evidence. And it's something that, you know, if you look at oncology, they don't wait for the guidelines to come out. They're just starting the meds. I mean, like, we do that off-label as well. But I think that on-label drugs that have proven data and clinicians just aren't using that information because they either don't have it at their fingertips, they may have heard of the trial, they may not have known the results, but they don't really know the use cases that well. Like, we're missing so many opportunities to adopt proven therapies in timely fashion. Like, it's absolutely really, you know, absolutely something that I think this is really striking at the core of. Mm-hmm.
And I think, right, one of the things that, you know, for me, moving from outcomes research into these large clinical trials, I think you still need so much more to be done with respect to implementation science, mm-hmm. right? Because we recognize how dissimilar the clinical trial environment is, as well as the patients who are willing to go through with rigor, certainty, and scheduling a clinical trial for years of their life versus the day-to-day care system in which our patients and providers have to work, and how dissimilar the patients that you see day in, day out. So we need to allow inferences across from the clinical trial data supported by real world evidence and understanding to help truly inform that decision at that patient provider interface. You know, what does it mean for patients like me with respect to the data? Are there data in patients like me? And again, I think it really needs to be an amalgam of the trial data, the evidence, real world data, experiential data, to come back and inform that in a much more meaningful way, in order to make a decision for the patient.
Yeah, that makes a ton of sense. I think that we at Clint are definitely working on some solutions that get closer to what your vision is. I think that we have a lot of work to do. And I think it's really, you know, with our current era of technology, the data that's available to us, the real world data and the clinical trial data, I think these things are very possible. They're just, you know, we're scratching the surface of what's possible in implementation science. And I think it has become really an art form of how do you motivate decision making to be more evidence-based, to be more quality focused and outcome focused for that individual patient. Physicians are interesting animals in terms of egos and experience and practice habits, and changing those can be challenging. I don't think one approach is probably the answer, but a multiple, multi-pronged
right.
approach, yeah, maybe is what we're heading
absolutely.
Towards.
The other thing that's important, right, to recognize, and dare I say it, you know, unfortunately, I believe our current healthcare system is not a healthcare system, right? It is not predicated or incentivized on maintenance of health. You know, it is an acute care medical system in which the incentives are also misaligned, you know, somewhat misaligned, right? That the reward, or the, at least the monetary reward of procedures, is far greater than of prevention. And so, so again, we have to be careful, not only insofar as how we try to move patients and providers, but how we incentivize, right? If we really do want to prevent disease, which I believe we have the power to do with probably the existing therapies we have, if we were just to apply them. But what are the rewards for those internist primary care physicians, yeah, day in, day out managing risk, versus a fee structure that more often rewards the event and paying for the event or the procedure? So it's many things, multi-pronged, definitely required.
When I don't know if I shared this with you, but, you know, Clint went to single payer health systems to talk to them about preventing incident stroke events in AFib patients that weren't on proper anticoagulation. And so we went to Australia, we went to Canada, we went to all these single payer health systems, NHS, and it's amazing how many strokes are happening when with patients not on appropriate anticoagulation for their AFib. And, you know, there was a state actually in Australia that was spending $350 million Australian dollars on just incident strokes, and roughly about two-thirds of them were preventable had they been on the right medications. But getting, you know, health systems to think about paying for prevention, even in single-payer health systems, is not easy. And certainly that's a large, slow-moving operation, but it's more of a system, as you said, because they are really they are incentivized for better outcomes for their patients. But even there, prevention is hard to sort of get people to get their heads around. And I really feel like, you know, partnerships between life science companies and health systems should be more and more a way that we can actually help achieve wins on both sides, because all of the hard work that and the money and the resources that go into bringing a drug to market that is truly game-changing, that truly lowers event rates and improve outcomes, should be partnering with the health system to make sure that those get into the market as quickly as they can. That's the way I feel. I don't know if that makes sense, but
no, it definitely resonates, right? And I think, you know, we have to recognize that, look, we have so many wonderful therapies, wonderful procedures to improve outcomes for patients, right? And I think what we want to do is apply that evidence base as best we can to improve health, right? Improve quality of life, longevity where possible, in a way that best supports the patient, right? And I think we, again, have so much opportunity, but again, it has to really be managed in a system across the lifetime of that patient, right? When things may make the most sense for them with respect to a therapy or a procedure, as we think about it.
Interesting. I wanted to go back a little bit in the career transitions that you had from being a professor at Harvard at that moment and then moving to Merck. And also then moving from the largest life science company, Janssen and Johnson & Johnson, to not a small company, but a much smaller company than Janssen and Esperion. And actually that transition is most interesting to me, which is, you know, certainly hindsight is 2020, and it's certainly been a tremendous success in the last 3 years, what you've been able to accomplish, in no small part due to your leadership role. But was that a difficult decision to go from this established, you know, behemoth in the industry in Janssen to a smaller company? And what was it that motivated you to make that move? I'd love to hear kind of your perspective on it.
Yeah, it's interesting, Raj. And I speak a fair amount on career development and to mentees and particularly women, right, that see this and they think about, well, how did you piece together your career? How did you get from here to here? And I think the thing that is most important is that, you know, I think when we start out in medical school, we have this idea that our lives will be this linear progression, right? That we will go from medical school to internship, residency, fellowship, faculty in this very linear way, right? And, you know, I like to think of it, and I often talk about it as a portfolio approach, right? And that life happens, opportunities arise, and that the only thing that's really consistent in that is your true north or your passion, right? So again, if I go back to some of the comments I made at the beginning, I think I'm always driven by my desire to make a difference, my desire to be impactful, particularly for patients and improving lives. And I come from a family that's really been ravaged by heart disease and lost many members far too early, that these decisions were ones that I was driven by the opportunity to make a difference. So when I left academia, as a preventive cardiologist to go to Merck. I felt that, you know, life sciences industry could provide a greater platform in which to execute my vision to improve health and develop transformational therapies on a larger scale. When I left J&J for the opportunity with Esperion, I think the other thing was, you know, first and foremost, I am a cardiologist. My passion has been cardiovascular medicine. And Big Pharma at that point had been somewhat divesting from broad cardiovascular profiles, which may not be the case now. Right. But the opportunity presented itself at Esperion to work on what could be, right, and now is, the first therapy since statins to reduce heart attack and cardiovascular events in patients at risk or with disease. Right. And so again, getting back to my roots in cholesterol and risk, it seemed very reasonable for me to do that. And I think, you know, again, as I always look to the future, I think for anyone, it's always, you know, following your passion, following, I've said it a bunch, North Star, if that's what the term is. and then everything makes sense, right? At least internally. May not make sense for other people. Why did Joanne do that? But it always makes sense to me, at least if I use some guiding principles.
Well, I mean, and do you feel like, I mean, I've met your team. Your team is amazing. You've assembled this incredible team that you've really empowered to just really achieve tremendous things over the last few years. And so have you treated it in any way a little bit? I've heard this from other people in industry that have made some somewhat comparable moves, to more like almost like a lab. Like you're able to kind of be more nimble, you're able to be more hands-on and present with the key pieces of your team and the key pieces of your company. Has that been the case?
Yeah, I think that's part of it, right, Raj? And I think it really, the opportunity presented itself in a way that I felt that I could bring all the best version of myself, best insights over the decades in the field, the best relationships across academia and industry to really bring a very small, passionate, nimble team together to execute in a way that was informed by academic experience and insights and knowledge, but also by industry experience, but also understanding what good or excellent looked like, and that it wasn't necessarily about having a lot of resources, but was about being resourceful and having people in on the team who shared that vision, who shared that passion for excellence, and who also recognized or had that commitment to patients in a very aligned way. And I think when you have teams, exceptional teams brought together that trust each other, that have that alignment, it does create that lab environment, right? That small group where you can think critically, you can share thoughts, you can have constructive debate about it and problem solve. And I think that's what we were able to do. And I would like to think that that small army of just a few people was able to do quite remarkable work in bringing this new therapy through to a label for patients.
That's amazing. And I'm going to try not to embarrass you, but I've got like quotes from people about you as a leader and as a colleague that I wanted to just share, which is really cool. So, I mean, some of the things that came through in some of my conversations with other people was just, Joanne is incredibly generous with her time and incredibly present when you're speaking to her, which I totally agree, and truly cares about the person as much as the job. That was someone's direct quote. Someone said, and you'll probably know who this was, they said, that Joanne is wicked smart. And I think you may know who that is. And then, of course, someone who is okay with me sharing who it was, you know, Fatima Rodriguez, a very close friend of mine and colleague at Stanford, a former mentee of yours. She said, Joanne is one of the most influential mentors of my career. I try to model my role as a mentor after her. And I think, you know, what you just said about it's not about having resources, it's about being resourceful. I'm going to start using that if that's okay. It's incredible to think about it in that way. And really, now Esperion is going to grow. I mean, you have now expanded labels, you have a product that has tremendous evidence behind it. And it's something that my co-founder at Clint, Sushant, and I talk about all the time. How do you preserve that culture and that mentorship that you've been able to provide clearly to your Esperion team as well as you continue to grow? Like, how do you actually preserve that culture in this now another inflection point of growth for you?
Yeah, Siraj, I think if I go back to Fatima's comment, you know, first and foremost, I see myself as a mentor, and I would hope that mentees can then take that experience, take those insights and inculcate it into their team, right? And then that's how the organization grows, you know, hopefully exponentially, any organization, right? But the culture has to start at the top and has to allow for those open, honest, critical conversations in order to improve. So it always comes from that spirit of improvement. But I think, again, the more you can then empower individuals to go out and internalize maybe some of those lessons and then be able to go out and find people that can support that culture, who want to lean into that kind of a culture, I think we can do great things. And, you know, not everyone wants to try and change the world, right? But there are people that you can find, and we've found an awful lot of people at Esperion who want to do that and come along for the ride. But people also have to be willing to lean into that culture and try to do big things or do things differently.
That's fantastic. Well, it's been a pleasure to watch, you know, and I remember when you made the transition to Esperion, and it was understandable, but also an exciting time and an uncertain time, of course, and things have become much more clear and much more visible in terms of all the work that you've been doing. So congratulations on that. What do you look forward to now for, what are your next challenges in front of you as you think about not just the growth, but also, you know, is it implementation science? Is it something around adoption? Like, what are the big initiatives that you're hoping to sort of pursue in the coming 1 to 2 years?
Yeah, so Raj, I think, you know, when I came to Esperion, obviously I was somewhat handed an already existing clinical development program. Our phase 3 trial was underway. You know, there was only so much to do to accelerate it and bring it in earlier. I think the thing that excites me now is the opportunity to take all these insights, right? Whether it be from academic practice, whether it be from industry, to really figure out how you can truly develop drugs from discovery all the way through, presumably, to clinical implementation by leveraging absolute best processes, best data, AI, machine learning, precision medicine. And I'll give you an example. I think, you know, thinking about bempedoic acid, it is a first-in-class ATP citrate lyase inhibitor. But it was developed with medicinal chemistry, old-school drug development. They needed a drug that would get into the liver, but wouldn't get into the muscle. And so the solution there was to have a prodrug that would be metabolized by an enzyme in the liver and only active. At that point, the ATP citrate lyase was unknown, had not been characterized.
Okay.
And now that it's been characterized, we at Esperion are really leveraging all our best tools, going back really to a blank slate, to say, well, what is it about this pathway that could be important for human diseases, right? Not do we want another lipid-lowering therapy, but what could be important? And so by doing that, by leveraging genomics, deeply phenotype data, incorporating tissue, biomarkers, a variety of other things, we've been able to really start from first principles to identify where this target could be most helpful in diseases. Diseases like MASH, diseases like within the liver, hepatocellular carcinoma, or in renal, the opportunity to move beyond into fibrotic conditions, cystic conditions in the kidney. But interestingly, right, it also allows us to think across diseases because of a unique anti-inflammatory, anti-fibrotic signal that has been identified through this work. And so I think if we had taken it the flip side and said, oh, well, we just want to build a better mousetrap, bempedoic acid 2.0, right? We would have missed so many significant opportunities, as I see it, to impact human disease, because we may have not been willing to see patterns in data because we had already made assumptions about where that should go. Oh, this is a lipid target. This is a metabolic. But by going back and using all the things we've used, you've used at Clint, we've used across the board to really think differently about drug development, I think this allows us to be much more effective, much more efficient, and potentially bring transformational opportunities rather than me-too opportunities as we think about modifying disease. So that's what excites me.
That's so cool. I mean, it sounds like that opens up, you know, so many avenues of clinical development for you in terms of new disease states, obviously, and not just lipid lowering, but anything, right? But also, you know, probably really appealing to your roots of studying fundamental mechanisms and being able to see something originate in terms of a new clinical development line. So yeah, that's,
and to prevent,
that's
super right? To prevent.
To prevent.
And I think, Raj, you know, you always know the, you know, let's not look under the lamppost, right? You know, where's the innovation? It doesn't occur where the light is necessarily being shown. Yep. So, you know, how do we make sure that we're not blinded by that light at the expense of looking for other opportunities? And I think there's such tremendous data, such tremendous science, so many tools to our avail now that should allow us to be truly transformational as we think about discovery and drug development for patients.
Well, that's awesome. And I think it's a great way to sort of wrap up our conversation today. It's been awesome to go through this journey on the podcast with you and hear about your path and how you've navigated so many challenges, but also turned them into tremendous opportunities. Joanne, thanks so much. I hope to see you soon at an upcoming conference. And
absolutely.
Thank you again for joining us today.
Thank you, Raj. Thank you very much.